their teeth in a wide grin. Beauvais showed videos in which this signal was being exchanged. Even though these scenes were new to the observing monkeys, they correctly picked the dominant party. The conclusion was that they have a concept of rank and are quick to evaluate the status of unknown individuals on the basis of how they interact with others. Ravens may show a similar understanding, as evidenced by their reactions to vocalizations played over a loudspeaker. Ravens recognize one another's voices and pay close attention to dominant and subordinate calls. But then the playbacks were manipulated to make it sound as if a dominant individual had turned submissive. Hearing evidence of a brewing overthrow, the ravens would stop what they were doing and listen while showing signs of distress. They were most upset by rank reversals among members of their own sex in their own group. But they reacted also to status reversals between ravens in an adjacent aviary. The investigators concluded that ravens have a concept of status that goes beyond their own position. They know how others typically interact and are alarmed by deviations from this pattern. In a related question, I have always wondered if captive chimpanzees evaluate status differences among the people around them. I once worked at a zoo with a demanding director who would occasionally visit the facilities and order everyone around, pointing out problems, saying this needed to be cleaned and that needed to be moved, and so on. Showing typical alpha conduct, he kept everyone on their toes, as a good director should. Even though the chimps rarely interacted with him, he never fed them or talked to them. They picked up on this behavior. They treated this man with the utmost respect, greeting him with submissive grunts from a great distance, which they didn't do for anyone else, as if they realized, here comes the boss, the one everyone around here is nervous about. It's not just in relation to dominance that chimpanzees make such judgments. One of the best illustrations of their triadic awareness occurs in mediated conflict resolution. After a fight between male combatants, a third party may induce them to make peace. Interestingly, it's only female chimps who do so, and only the highest-ranking ones among them. They step in when two male rivals fail to reconcile. The male rivals may be sitting near each other and avoiding eye contact, unable or unwilling to make the first move. If a third male were to approach, even to make peace, he'd be perceived as a party to the conflict. Male chimps form alliances all the time, so their presence is never neutral. This is where the older females come in. The matriarch of the Arnhem colony, Mama, was the mediator par excellence. No male would ignore her or carelessly start a fight that might incur her wrath. She would approach one of the males and groom him for a while, then slowly walk toward his rival while being followed by the first. She would look around to check on the first and return to tug at his arm if he was reluctant. Then she'd sit down next to the second male, while both males would groom her, one on each side. Finally, Mama would slip away from the scene, and the males would pant, splutter, and smack more loudly than before, sounds that signal grooming enthusiasm. But by then they would, of course, be grooming each other. In other chimpanzee colonies, too, I have seen old females reduce male tensions. It is a risky affair. The males are obviously in a grumpy mood, which is why younger females, instead of trying to mediate themselves, encourage others to do so. They approach the top female while looking around at the males who are refusing to make up. This way, they try to get something going that they can't accomplish safely by themselves. Such behavior demonstrates how much chimpanzees know about the social relationships of others, such as what has happened between the rival males, what has to be done to restore harmony, and who will be the best one to undertake this mission. It is the sort of knowledge that we take for granted in our own species. But without it, animal social life could never have reached its known complexity. Proof in the pudding. While cleaning out the old library at the Yerkes Primate Center, we unearthed forgotten treasures. One was the old wooden desk of Robert Yerkes, which is now my personal desk. The other was a film that probably had not been looked at for half a century. It took us a while to find the right projector, but it was worth the trouble. Lacking sound, the film had written titles inserted in between poor-quality black-and-white scenes. It featured two young chimpanzees working together on a task. In true slapstick style, befitting the movie's flickering format, one of the chimps would slap the other on her back every time her dedication flagged. I have shown a digitized version to many audiences, causing much laughter in recognition of human-like encouragements. People are quick to grasp the movie's essence. Apes have a solid understanding of the advantages of cooperation. The experiment was run in the 1930s by Meredith Crawford, a student of Yerkes. We see two juveniles, Beulah and Bimba, pulling at ropes attached to a heavy box outside their cage. Food has been placed on the box, which is too heavy for one of them to pull in alone. The synchronized pulling by Beulah and Bimba is remarkable. They do so in four or five bursts, so well coordinated that you'd almost think they were counting one, two, three, pull, but of course they are not. In a second phase, Beulah has been fed so much that her motivation has evaporated and her performance is lackluster. Bimba solicits her every now and then, poking her or pushing her hand toward the rope. Once they have successfully brought the box within reach, Beulah barely collects any food, leaving it all to Bimba. Why did Beulah work so hard with so little interest in the payoff? The likely answer is reciprocity. These two chimps know each other and probably live together, so that every favor they do for each other will likely be repaid. They are buddies, and buddies help each other out. This pioneering study contains all the ingredients later expanded upon by more rigorous research. The cooperative pulling paradigm, as it is known, has been applied to monkeys, hyenas, parrots, rooks, elephants, and so on. The pulling is less successful if the partners are prevented from seeing each other, so success rests on true coordination. It is not as if the two individuals pull at random and, by luck, happen to pull together. Furthermore, primates prefer partners who cooperate eagerly and are tolerant enough to share the prize. They also understand that a partner's labor requires repayment. Capuchin monkeys, for example, seem to appreciate each other's effort in that they share more food with a partner who has helped them obtain it than with one whose help went unheeded. Given all this evidence, one wonders why the social sciences, in recent years, have settled on the curious idea that human cooperation represents a huge anomaly in the natural realm. It has become commonplace to assert that only humans truly understand how cooperation works, or know how to handle competition and freeloading. Animal cooperation is presented as mostly based on kinship, as if mammals were social insects. This idea was quickly disproven when field workers analyzed DNA extracted from the feces of wild chimpanzees, which allowed them to determine genetic relatedness. They concluded that the vast majority of mutual aid in the forest occurs between unrelated apes. Captive studies have shown that even strangers, primates who didn't know each other before they were put together, can be enticed to share food or exchange favors. Despite these findings, the human uniqueness meme keeps stubbornly replicating. Are its proponents oblivious to the rampant, varied, and massive cooperation found in nature? I just attended a conference on collective behavior, from cells to societies, which addressed the extraordinary ways in which single cells, organisms, and entire species realize goals together. Our best theories about the evolution of cooperation stem from the study of animal behavior. Summarizing these ideas in his 1975 book, Sociobiology, E.O. Wilson helped launch the evolutionary approach to human behavior. Excitement about Wilson's grand synthesis seems to have faded, though. Perhaps it was too sweeping and inclusive for disciplines that consider humans in isolation. Chimpanzees in particular are nowadays often depicted as so aggressive and competitive that they can't be truly cooperative. If this applies to our closest relatives, so the thinking goes, we can justifiably ignore the rest of the animal kingdom. One prominent advocate of this position, the American psychologist Michael Tomasello, extensively compared children and apes, which has led him to conclude that our species is the only one capable of shared intentions in relation to common goals. He once condensed his view in the catchy statement, "It is inconceivable that you would ever see two chimpanzees carrying a log together." This is quite an assertion, given Emil Menzel's photographed and filmed sequences of juvenile apes recruiting one another to collectively prop a heavy pole up against the wall of their enclosure in order to get out. I have regularly seen chimps use long sticks as ladders to get across hot wire surrounding live beech trees. One chimp holds the stick, while another scales it to reach fresh leaves without getting shocked. We have also videotaped two adolescent females who regularly tried to reach the window of my office, which overlooks the chimp compound at the Yerkes Field Station. Both females would exchange hand gestures while moving a heavy plastic drum right underneath my window. One ape would jump onto the drum, after which the other would climb on top of her and stand on her shoulders. The two females would then synchronously bob up and down like a giant spring. The one standing on top would reach for my window every time she came close. Well synchronized and clearly of the same mind, these females played this game often in alternating roles. Since they never succeeded, their common goal was largely imaginary. Literally carrying a log together may not be part of these efforts, but this behavior is trained for all the time in Asian elephants. Until recently, the forest industry of Southeast Asia employed elephants as beasts of burden. Now they are rarely used for this purpose anymore, but they still demonstrate their skills for tourists. At the Elephant Conservation Center near Chiang Mai in Thailand, two tall adolescent bulls will effortlessly pick up a long log with their tusks, each standing on one end, draping their trunks over the log to keep it from rolling off. Then they will walk in perfect unison several meters apart with the log between them, while the two mahouts on their necks sit chatting and laughing and looking around. They are most certainly not directing every move. Training is obviously part of this picture, but one cannot train any animal to be so coordinated. One can train dolphins to jump synchronously because they do so in the wild, and one can teach horses to run together at the same pace because wild horses do the same. Trainers build on natural abilities. Obviously, if one elephant were to walk slightly faster than the other while carrying the log or hold it at the wrong height, the whole enterprise would quickly unravel. The task requires step-by-step harmonization of rhythm and movement by the bulls themselves. They have moved from an I identity, I perform this task, to a we identity, we do this together, which is the hallmark of collective action. They end their performance by lowering the log together, moving it from their tusks into their trunks, and then slowly to the ground. They set the heaviest log down on a pile without a single sound, impeccably coordinated. When Josh Plotnick tested elephants on the cooperative pulling paradigm, he found a solid understanding for the need to synchronize. Teamwork is even more typical of group hunters, such as humpback whales, which blow hundreds of bubbles around a school of fish. The column of bubbles traps the fish like a net. The whales act together to make the column tighter and tighter until several of them surface through its center with mouths wide open to swallow the bounty. Orcas go even further, in an action so astonishingly well-coordinated that few species, including humans, would be able to match it. When orcas along the Antarctic Peninsula spot a seal on an ice floe, they reposition the floe. It takes lots of hard work, but they push it out into open water. Then four or five whales line up side by side, acting like one giant whale. They rapidly swim in perfect unison toward the flow, creating a high wave that washes off the unlucky seal. We don't know how the killer whales agree on the lineup or how they synchronize their actions, but they must be communicating about it before making their move. It is not entirely clear why they do it, because even though the orcas afterward carry the seal around, they often end up releasing it. One seal was deposited back onto a different ice floe to live another day. On land, lions, wolves, wild dogs, Harris's hawks, teams of which control the pigeons in London's Trafalgar Square, capuchin monkeys, and so on, exhibit plenty of tight teamwork too. The Swiss primatologist Christopher Busch has described how chimpanzees hunt colobus monkeys in Ivory Coast. Some males act as drivers, while others take up distant positions high up in a tree as ambushers, waiting for the monkey troop to escape in their direction through the canopy. Since these hunts take place in the dense jungle of Thai National Park, and both the chimps and the monkeys are dispersed, it is hard to pinpoint what is going on in three-dimensional space, but it appears to involve role division and the anticipation of prey movement. The prey is captured by one of the ambushers, who potentially could quietly slink away with the meat, but does exactly the opposite. During the hunt, the chimps are silent, but as soon as a monkey is captured, they erupt in a pandemonium of hooting and screaming that draws everyone in, leading to a large cluster of males, females, and young jostling for position. I once stood under a tree in a different forest while this happened, and the deafening noise above me left little doubt about how highly chimps prize their meat. Sharing appears to favor hunters over latecomers. Even the alpha male may go empty-handed if he failed to participate. The chimpanzees seem to recognize contributions to success. The communal feast that ensues is the only way to sustain this sort of cooperation, because why would anyone invest in a joint enterprise if not for the prospect of a joint payoff? These observations obviously contradict the view that chimpanzees and other animals lack joint action based on shared intentions. One can imagine the head-butting between two scientists with such diametrically opposite views as Busch and Tomasello, who have offices in the same building. Was their appointment as co-directors of the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig an experiment on how human collaboration fares in the face of disagreement? Given these divergent perspectives, let me return to the experiments that led Tomasello to his human uniqueness claim. After testing both children and apes on a cooperative pulling task, he concluded that only the children exhibit shared intentionality. The question of comparability has come up before, however, and fortunately there are photographs of the respective setups. One shows two apes in separate cages, each with a little plastic table in front of him that he can pull closer with a rope. Oddly, the apes do not occupy a shared space, as in Crawford's classical study. Their cages are not even adjacent. There is distance and two layers of mesh between them, a situation that hampers visibility and communication. Each ape focuses on its own end of the rope, seemingly unaware of what the other is up to. The photo of the children, in contrast, shows them sitting on the carpeting of a large room with no barriers between them. They, too, are using a pulling apparatus, but they sit side by side in full view of each other and are free to move around, touch each other, and talk. These different arrangements go a long way toward explaining why the children showed shared purpose and the apes did not. Had this comparison concerned two different species, rats and mice, say, we would never have accepted such dissimilar setups. If rats had been tested on a joint task while sitting side by side and mice while being kept apart, no sensible scientist would permit the conclusion that rats are smarter or more cooperative than mice. We'd demand the same procedure. Comparisons between children and apes get exceptional leeway, however, which is why studies keep perpetuating cognitive differences that, in my mind, are impossible to separate from methodological ones. In view of the ongoing controversy, we decided to move away from pairwise testing, whether separate or together, and develop a more naturalistic setup. I sometimes refer to it as our proof-in-the-pudding experiment, since we sought to determine once and for all how well chimps handle conflicting interests, what happens to cooperation in the face of competition. The only way to see which tendency prevails is to provide an opportunity for the chimpanzees to express both at the same time. My student Malini Suchak came up with the right apparatus to test a colony of 15 chimps at the Yerkes Field Station. Mounted on the fence of their outdoor enclosure was an apparatus that required very precise coordination to be moved closer to obtain rewards. Either two or three individuals had to pull at exactly the same time at separate bars. To coordinate with two partners was harder than with only one, but the apes had no trouble either way. They were sitting spaced out, but in full view of one another. Since the whole group was present, there were many possible partner configurations. The apes could decide who to work with while also being on the alert for competitors, such as dominant males or females, as well as freeloaders who might steal rewards without doing any work. They could freely exchange information and freely choose partners, but also freely compete. No large-scale experiment of this kind had ever been tried. If it is true that chimps can't overcome competition, the test should produce total chaos. The colony should descend into a bickering bunch of apes, fighting over rewards and chasing one another away from the test site. Competitiveness should kill all shared objectives. I knew chimps long enough, however, that I didn't worry much about the outcome of this test. I had studied conflict resolution among them for decades. Despite their poor reputation, I had seen too many scenes of chimpanzees trying to keep the peace and reduce tensions to worry that they would all of a sudden abandon such efforts. Since Malini and the rest of us wished to see if the chimps could figure out the task on their own, she gave them no pre-training at all. All they knew was that there was a new apparatus and that food was associated with it. They proved remarkably quick learners, realizing that they had to work together and mastering both two-way and three-way pulls within days. Sitting next to one of the pull bars, Rita would look up at her mother, Bori, who was asleep in a nest on top of a tall climbing frame. She'd climb up all the way to poke Bori in her ribs until she would come down with her. Rita would head for the apparatus, all the while looking over her shoulder to make sure Mom was following. Sometimes we had the impression that the chimps had reached an agreement without us knowing how. Two of them would walk side by side out of the night building, which is quite a distance away, and together head straight for the apparatus, as if they knew exactly what they were going to do. Talk about shared intentionality. The main point of the study was to see if the apes would compete or cooperate. Clearly, cooperation won big time. We saw some aggression, but virtually no injuries. Most fights were low-level, such as pulling at someone to drag him or her away from the apparatus, chasing someone off, or throwing sand. Individuals also tried to gain access by grooming one of the pullers until this individual allowed them to take their spot. Cooperation at the apparatus went on almost nonstop, resulting in a total of 3,565 joint pulls. Freeloaders were avoided and occasionally punished for their activities, while overly competitive individuals quickly found out how unpopular their behavior made them. The experiment was conducted over many months, affording plenty of time for all the chimps to learn that tolerance paid off in terms of finding partners to work with. In the end, we found proof in the pudding that chimpanzees are highly cooperative. They have no trouble whatsoever regulating and dampening strife for the sake of achieving shared outcomes. One possible reason that the behavior we observed was more in line with what is known from the natural habitat may be our colony's background. By the time we tested them, our chimps had lived together for almost 4 decades. This is a long time by any standard, resulting in an unusually well-integrated group. But when we recently tested a newly formed group in which many individuals had known one another for only a few years, we found the same high level of cooperation and low level of aggression. In other words, chimpanzees are generally good at conflict management for the sake of cooperation. The current reputation of chimpanzees as violent and belligerent, demonic even, is almost entirely based on the way they treat members of neighboring groups in the wild. They occasionally carry out brutal attacks over territory. This fact has tainted their image, even though lethal combat is so rare that it took decades for scientists to agree on its occurrence. The rate of fatalities at any given field site is on average once every 7 years. Moreover, it is not as if this behavior sets chimpanzees apart from ourselves. So why is it used as an argument against their cooperative nature, whereas in our own species, intergroup warfare is rightly viewed as a collective enterprise? The same holds for chimpanzees. They almost never attack neighbors on their own. It is time for us to see them for what they are. Talented team players who have no trouble suppressing conflicts within their group. A recent experiment, the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, confirmed their cooperative skills. Scientists let a group of chimpanzees fish with dipsticks for ketchup that was stored in the holes of an artificial termite mound. At the beginning of the experiment, there were enough holes for all members to feed independently. But then the number of holes was reduced by one each day until there were very few left. Since each hole was monopolizable, it was thought that the chimps would compete and squabble over access to the dwindling resource. But nothing of the kind happened. They adjusted to their new situation by doing the exact opposite. They peacefully gathered around the remaining holes, usually two at a time, sometimes in trios, dipping their sticks into them in alternation, each chimp politely awaiting his or her turn. Instead of a rise in conflict, all the scientists observed was sharing and turn-taking. When two or more intelligent, cooperative species meet around food resources, the outcome may also be cooperation rather than competition. Each species knows how to take advantage of the other. Fishing cooperatives in which humans and cetaceans, whales and dolphins, work together are probably thousands of years old, having been reported from Australia and India to the Mediterranean and Brazil. In South America, they operate on the mud shores of lagoons. Fishermen announce their arrival by slapping the water, upon which bottlenose dolphins emerge to herd mullet toward them. The fishers wait for a signal from the dolphins, such as a distinctive type of dive, to throw their nets. The dolphins also do such herding among themselves, but here they drive the fish toward the fishermen's nets. The men know their dolphin partners individually, having named them after famous politicians and soccer players. Even more spectacular are the cooperatives between humans and killer whales. When whaling still occurred around Twofold Bay in Australia, orcas would approach the whaling station to perform conspicuous breaching and lobtailing that served to announce the arrival of a humpback whale. They would herd the large whale into shallow waters close to a whaling vessel, allowing the whalers to harpoon the harassed leviathan. Once the whale was killed, the orcas would be given one day to consume their preferred delicacy, its tongue and lips, after which the whalers would collect their prize. Here, too, humans gave names to their preferred orca partners and recognized the tit-for-tat, that is the foundation of all cooperation, human as well as animal. There is only one area in which human cooperation goes well beyond what we know of other species, its degree of organization and scale. We have hierarchical structures to set up projects of a complexity and duration not found elsewhere in nature. Most animal cooperation is self-organized in that individuals fulfill roles according to their capacities. Sometimes animals coordinate as if they have agreed on a task division beforehand. We do not know how shared intentions and goals are communicated, but they do not seem to be orchestrated from above by leaders, as in humans. We develop a plan and put a hierarchy in place to manage its execution, which allows us to lay a railroad track across the country or build a huge cathedral that takes generations to complete. Relying on age-old evolved tendencies, we have shaped our societies into complex networks of cooperation that can take on projects of an unprecedented magnitude. Fishy cooperation. Cooperation experiments often ask cognitive questions. Do the actors realize they need a partner? Do they know the partner's role? Are they prepared to share the spoils? If one individual were to hog all the benefits, this obviously would imperil future cooperation. So we assume that animals watch not only what they get, but also what they get compared to what their partner gets. Inequity is something to worry about. This insight inspired an immensely popular experiment that Sarah Brosnan and I conducted with pairs of brown capuchins. After they performed a task, we rewarded both monkeys with cucumber slices and grapes, after determining that they all favored the latter over the former. The monkeys had no trouble with the task if they received identical rewards, even if they both got cucumber. But they were vehemently opposed to unequal outcomes if one got grapes and the other got cucumber. The cucumber monkey would contentedly munch on her first slice, but after noticing that her companion was getting grapes, she would throw a tantrum. She'd ditch her measly veggies and shake the testing chamber with such agitation that it threatened to break apart. Refusing perfectly fine food because someone else is better off resembles the way humans react in economic games. Economists call this response irrational, since getting something is by definition better than getting nothing. No monkey, they say, should ever refuse food that she'd normally eat, and no human should reject a small offer. $1 is still better than no dollar. Sarah and I are unconvinced that this kind of reaction is irrational, though, since it seeks to equalize outcomes, which is the only way to keep cooperation flowing. Apes may even go further than monkeys in this respect. Sarah found that chimpanzees sometimes protest inequity that goes the other way. They object not only to getting less than the others, but also to getting more. Grape receivers may reject their own advantage. This obviously brings us close to the human sense of fairness. Without going into further details, something encouraging happened in these studies. They were soon extended to other species, including outside the primates. It is always a sign of a field's maturity when it expands. Researchers who applied inequity tests to dogs and corvids found reactions similar to those of the monkeys. Apparently, no species can escape the logic of cooperation, whether it involves the selection of good partners or the balance between effort and payoff. The generality of these principles is best illustrated by the work on fish by Redouan Bichawi, a Swiss ethologist and ichthyologist. For years, Bichawi has been enchanting us with observations of the interplay and mutualism between small, cleaner wrasses and their hosts, the large fish from which the cleaners nibble away ectoparasites. Each cleaner fish owns a station on a reef with a clientele, which come and spread their pectoral fins and adopt postures that offer the cleaner a chance to do its job. In perfect mutualism, the cleaner removes parasites from the client's body surface, gills, and even the inside of its mouth. Sometimes the cleaner is so busy that clients have to wait in queue. Bichawi's research consists of observations on the reef, but also experiments in the laboratory. His papers read much like a manual for good business practice. For example, cleaners treat roaming fish better than residents. If a roamer and a resident arrive at the same time, the cleaner will service the roamer first. Residents can be kept waiting since they have nowhere else to go. The whole process is one of supply and demand. Cleaners occasionally cheat by taking little bites of healthy skin out of their client. Clients don't like this and jolt or swim away. The only clients that cleaners never cheat are predators, which possess a radical counter-strategy. To swallow them. The cleaners seem to have an excellent understanding of the costs and benefits of their actions. In a set of studies in the Red Sea, Bashari observed coordinated hunting between the leopard coral trout, a beautiful reddish-brown grouper that can grow to 3 feet in length, and the giant moray eel. These two species make a perfect match. The moray eel can enter crevices in the coral reef, whereas the trout hunts in the open waters around it. Prey can escape from the trout by hiding in a crevice, and from the eel by entering open water, but it cannot get away from the two of them together. In one of Bashari's videos, we see a coral trout and a moray eel swimming side by side like friends on a stroll. They seek each other's company, with the trout sometimes actively recruiting an eel through a curious head shake close to the eel's head. The latter responds to the invitation by leaving its crevice and joining the trout. Given that the two species don't share the prey with each other but swallow it whole, their behavior seems a form of cooperation in which each achieves a reward without sacrificing anything for the other. They are out for their own gain, which they attain more easily together than alone. The observed role division comes naturally to two predators with different hunting styles. What is truly spectacular is that the entire pattern, two actors who seemingly know what they are going to do and how it will benefit them, is not one we usually associate with fish. We have lots of cognitively high-level explanations for our own behavior, and find it hard to believe that the same might apply to animals with much smaller brains. But lest one think that the fish are showing a simplified form of cooperation, Bashari's recent work challenges this notion. Coral trout were presented with a fake moray eel, a plastic model capable of performing a few actions, such as coming out of a tube, that was able to help them catch fish. The setup followed the same logic as the pulling tests in which chimpanzees recruit help when needed, but not if they can complete the task alone. The trout acted in every way similar to the apes, and were equally adept at deciding on their need for a partner. One way to look at this outcome is to say that chimpanzee cooperation may be simpler than we thought, but another is to say that fish may have a better understanding of how cooperation works than we have been willing to assume. Whether all this boils down to associative learning by the fish remains to be seen. If it does, then any kind of fish should be able to develop this behavior. That seems doubtful, and I agree with Bashari that a species' cognition is tied to its evolutionary history and ecology. Combined with field observations of cooperative hunting between coral trout and moray eels, the experiment suggests a cognition that suits the hunting techniques of both species. Since the trout takes most of the initiatives and decisions, it may all depend on the specialized intelligence of only one species. These exciting excursions into non-mammals fit the comparative approach that is the hallmark of evolutionary cognition. There is no single form of cognition, and there is no point in ranking cognitions from simple to complex. A species' cognition is generally as good as what it needs for its survival. Distant species that face similar needs may arrive at similar solutions, as also happened in the domain of Machiavellian power strategies. After my discovery of divide-and-rule tactics in chimpanzees and Nishida's confirmation of their use in the wild, we now have a report on ravens. It is perhaps no accident that it came from a young Dutchman, Jörg Maassen, who spent years with the chimps at Burkert's Zoo before he set out to follow wild ravens in the Austrian Alps. There he observed many separating interventions in which one bird would interrupt a friendly contact between others, such as mutual preening, either by attacking one of them or by inserting itself between them. The intervener gained no direct benefits. There was no food or mating at stake. but did manage to ruin a bonding session between others. Bonds are important to ravens because, as Masson explains, their status depends on them. High-ranking ravens are generally well-bonded, whereas the middle category are loosely bonded, and the lowest birds lack special bonds. Since interventions were mostly carried out by well-bonded birds targeting loosely bonded ones, their main goal may have been to prevent the latter from establishing friendships in order to rise in status. This begins to look a lot like chimpanzee politics, which is exactly what one would expect in a large-brained species with a healthy power drive. Jumbo politics. We tend to think of elephants as matriarchal, and this is entirely correct. Elephant herds consist of females with young, occasionally followed around by one or two grown bulls eager to mate. The bulls are only hangers-on. It is hard to apply the term politics to these herds, since the females are ranked by age, family, and perhaps personality, all of which traits are stable. There isn't much room for the status competition and the opportunistic making and breaking of alliances that marks political strife. For this, we have to go to the males, also in the elephant. For the longest time, bull elephants have been viewed as loners who travel up and down the savanna and occasionally get behaviorally transformed by the state of must. Jolted by a 20-fold increase in testosterone, a bull changes into a sort of spinach-eating Popeye, a self-confident jerk ready to fight anyone in his path. Not many animals have such a physiological oddball thrown into their social system. But now we learn from the work by American zoologist Caitlin O'Connell in Etosha National Park in Namibia that there is more going on. African elephant bulls are far more sociable than assumed. They may not move in herds like the cows, who stick together to keep predators from bringing down their young, but they know one another individually and have leaders, followers, and semi-permanent associations. In some ways, O'Connell's descriptions remind me of primate politics, but at other times they sound odd due to the strange ways elephants communicate. For example, a leading bull, wary of another, may drop his penis during a butt-jiggling retreat. What is going on here? He is awkwardly walking backward, while his penis, which is pretty obvious in an elephant, serves as a signal. Why not retract it at such moments? They drop it in submission, or as O'Connell calls it, supplication. On the dominant side as well, their behavior is highly unusual. Here, a description of a must display. He was so agitated that he walked over to the place where Greg had previously defecated and performed a dramatic must display over the offending pile of feces, dribbling urine and curling his trunk over his head, waving his ears and prancing with his front legs in the air, mouth wide open. It used to be thought that the older and larger a bull, the higher ranking he'd be. If so, this system would be rather inflexible. O'Connell, however, documented status reversals. One leading male gradually lost his ability to rally followers. He would fan his ears and emit a "let's go" rumble, but no one would pay any heed the way they had done in earlier years. His coalition was falling apart, whereas it previously had shown impressive cohesion. One sign of an intact boys' club is that the dominant bull's vocalizations are echoed by the bulls around him. A subordinate's call starts at the moment the dominant's call ends, followed by yet another subordinate, and yet another, resulting in a cascade of repeated calls among the bulls that signal to the rest of the world that they are tight and united. Elephant coalitions are subtle, and everything these animals do seems a slow-motion movie to the human eye. Sometimes two bulls will deliberately stand right next to each other with ears out, so as to indicate to an opponent that it is time to leave the waterhole. These coalitions dominate the scene, usually arranged around a clear leader. Other bulls come to pay their respect to him, approaching him with outstretched trunk, quivering in trepidation, dipping the tip into his mouth in an act of trust. After performing this tense ritual, the lower-ranking bulls relax, as if a burden has been taken off their shoulders. These scenes are reminiscent of how dominant male chimpanzees expect subordinates to crawl in the dust while uttering submissive grunts, not to mention human status rituals, such as kissing the ring of the dawn, or Saddam Hussein's insistence that his underlings stick their nose under his armpit. Our species is quite creative when it comes to reinforcement of the hierarchy. We are familiar enough with these processes to recognize them in other animals. As soon as power is based on alliances rather than individual size or force, the door opens to calculated strategies. Given elephant intelligence in other domains, there is every reason to expect pachyderm society to be as complex as that of other political animals. Chapter 7. Time will tell. What is time? Leave now for dogs and apes. Man has forever. Robert Browning, 1896. Judging the gap between two trees, a monkey relies on its memory of past jumps to calculate the next one. Is there a landing spot on the other side? Is it within jumping distance? Can the branch handle its impact? These life and death decisions take a great deal of experience to make and show how past and future intertwine in a species' behavior. The past provides the required practice, whereas the future is where the next move will take place. Long-range future orientation is also common, such as when during a drought, the matriarch of an elephant herd remembers a drinking hole miles away that no one else knows about. The herd sets out on a long trek, taking days to reach precious water. While the matriarch operates on the basis of knowledge, the rest of the herd operates on the basis of trust. Whether it is a matter of seconds or days, animal behavior is not only goal, but also future-oriented. So it is curious to me that animals are often thought to be stuck in the present. The present is ephemeral. One moment it is here, the next it is gone. Whether you were a thrush picking up a worm for your chicks in a distant nest, or a dog setting out in the morning to patrol your territory and dribble urine at strategic locations, animals have jobs to do, which imply the future. True, most of the time it is the near future, and it remains unclear how aware they are of it, yet their behavior would make no sense if they lived entirely in the present. We ourselves consciously reflect on the past and the future, so it was perhaps unavoidable that whether animals do or don't would become a battleground. Isn't consciousness what sets humans apart? Some claim that we are the only ones to actively recall the past and imagine the future, but others have been busy gathering evidence to the contrary. Since no one can prove conscious reflection without verbal reports, the debate skirts subjective experience as something that, at least for now, we can't put our finger on. There has been genuine progress, though, in the exploration of how animals relate to the time dimension. Of all areas of evolutionary cognition, this one is perhaps the most esoteric and the hardest to get a handle on. The terminology shifts regularly, and debates are fierce. For this reason, I have visited two experts to ask them where we currently stand, which opinions will be presented at the end of this chapter. In Search of Lost Time. Perhaps the controversy started earlier than we think, because in the 1920s, an American psychologist, Edward Tolman, bravely and controversially asserted that animals are capable of more than the mindless linking between stimulus and response. He rejected the idea of them as purely incentive-driven. He dared use the term cognitive. He was famous for his studies of cognitive maps in maze-learning rats, and called animals purposive, guided by goals and expectations, both of which reference the future. While Tolman, in a bow to the suffocating grip of the era's classical behaviorism, shied away from the stronger term purposeful, his student, Otto Tinkelpaw, designed an experiment in which a macaque watched either a lettuce leaf or a banana being placed under a cup. As soon as the monkey was given access, she ran to the baited cup. If she found the food that she had seen being hidden, everything proceeded smoothly. But if the experimenter had replaced the banana with lettuce, the monkey only stared at the reward. She'd frantically look around, inspecting the location over and over, while angrily shrieking at the sneaky experimenter. Only after a long delay would she settle for the disappointing vegetable. From a behaviorist perspective, her attitude was bizarre, since animals are supposed to merely connect behavior with rewards, any rewards. The nature of the reward shouldn't matter. Tinkelpaw, however, demonstrated that there is more going on. Guided by a mental representation of what she had seen being hidden, the monkey had developed an expectation, the violation of which deeply upset her. Instead of merely preferring one behavior over another or one cup over another, the monkey recalled a specific event. It was as if she were saying, "Hey, I swear I saw them put a banana under that cup." Such precise recall of events is known as episodic memory, which was long thought to require language, hence to be uniquely human. Animals were thought to be good at learning the general consequences of behavior without retaining any specifics. This position has become shaky, though. Let me give an example that is a bit more striking, since it involves a much longer time frame than the monkey experiment. We once applied a Menzel-type test to Sacco when he was still an adolescent chimpanzee. Through a small window, Sacco watched my assistant hide an apple in a large tractor tire in the outdoor enclosure, while the rest of the colony was kept behind closed doors. Then we released the colony, holding Sacco back until last. The first thing he did after coming out the door was to climb onto the tire and peek into it, checking on the apple. He left it alone, though, and nonchalantly walked away from the scene. He waited for more than 20 minutes until everyone was otherwise occupied, and then went to collect the fruit. This was clever, since he might otherwise have lost his prize. The truly interesting twist came years later, however, when we repeated this experiment. Sacco had been tested only once, and we showed the video to a visiting camera crew. But as is typical, the crew trusted its own filming better and insisted on redoing the whole test. By this time, Sacco was the alpha male and hence could not be used anymore. Being of high rank, he would have had no reason to conceal what he knew about hidden food, so instead we selected a low-ranking female named Natasha and did everything nearly the same. We locked up all the chimps and let Natasha watch through the window while we hid an apple. This time we dug a hole in the ground, put the apple into it, and covered it with sand and leaves. We did this so well that afterward we barely knew where we'd put the fruit. After the others were released, Natasha finally entered the enclosure. We waited anxiously, following her with several cameras. She showed a pattern similar to Sacco's, and moreover displayed a far better sense of location than we did. She passed slowly over to the precise hiding spot, then returned 10 minutes later to confidently dig up the fruit. While she did so, Sacco stared at her with apparent surprise. It is not every day that someone pulls an apple out of the ground. I worried that Sacco might punish her for snacking right in front of him. But no, Sacco ran straight to the tractor tire. He looked into it from several angles, but obviously it was empty. It was as if he had concluded that we were hiding fruit again, and he recalled the exact location we had used before. This was most remarkable, since I am pretty sure Sacco had had only one experience of this kind in his whole life, which had occurred 5 years earlier. Was this mere coincidence? It is hard to tell based on a single event. But fortunately, a Spanish scientist, Gemma Martín Ordaz, had been testing out this sort of memory. Working with a large number of chimpanzees and orangutans, she tested the apes on what they remembered of past events. Previously, the apes had been given a task that required them to find the right tool to fetch either a banana or frozen yogurt. The apes had watched tools being hidden in boxes, after which they needed to pick the right box to get a tool for the task. This being easy for apes, all went well. But 3 years later, after the apes had gone through scores of other events and tests, they all of a sudden encountered the same person, Martín Ordaz, presenting the same setup in the same rooms of the building. Would the presence of the same investigator and situation cue the apes about the challenge they faced? Would they know right away what tool to use and where to look for it? They did, or at least those with previous experience did. Naive apes did nothing of the kind, thus confirming the role of memory. And not only that, the apes did not hesitate. They solved the problem in a matter of seconds. Most animal learning is of a rather vague kind, similar to how I've learned to avoid some Atlanta highways at certain times of the day. Having gotten stuck in traffic often enough, I will look for a better, faster route without any specific memory of what happened on my previous commute. This is also how a rat in a maze learns to turn one way and not another, and how a bird learns what time of day to find breadcrumbs at my parents' balcony. This kind of learning is all around us. What we deem a special kind, the one at issue here, is the recall of particulars, the way the French novelist Marcel Proust, in Search of Lost Time, dwelled on the taste of a petit merlin. The little tea-soaked biscuit made him relive his childhood visits to Aunt Leonie. No sooner had the warm liquid mixed with the crumbs touched my palate than a shudder ran through me, and I stopped, intent upon the extraordinary thing that was happening to me. The power of autobiographical memories lies in their specificity. Colorful and alive, they can be actively called up and dwelled upon. They are reconstructions, which is why they are sometimes false, yet so powerful that they are accompanied by an extraordinary sense of their correctness. They fill us with emotions and sensations, as happened to Proust. You mention someone's wedding day or dad's funeral, and all sorts of memories about the weather, the guests, the food, the happiness or the sadness will flood the mind. This kind of memory must be at work when apes react to cues connected to events from years back. The same memory serves foraging wild chimpanzees, which visit about a dozen fruit-bearing trees per day. How do they know where to go? The forest has far too many trees to go about it randomly. Working in Thai National Park in Ivory Coast, the Dutch primatologist Carleen Janmaat found apes to have an excellent recall of previous meals. They mostly checked trees at which they had eaten in previous years. If they ran into copious ripe fruit, they'd gorge on it while grunting contentedly and make sure to return a couple of days later. Janmaat describes how the chimps would build their daily nests, in which they sleep for only one night en route to such trees, and get up before dawn, something they normally hate to do. The intrepid primatologist followed the traveling party on foot, but whereas the chimps typically ignored her trippings or stepping on a noisy branch, now they would all turn around and stare pointedly at her, making her feel bad. Sounds draw attention, and the chimps were on edge in the dark. This was understandable, since one of the females had recently lost her infant to a leopard. Despite their deep-seated fear, the apes would set out on a long trek to a specific fig tree where they had recently eaten. Their goal was to beat the early fig rush. These soft, sweet fruits are favored by many forest animals, from squirrels to flocks of hornbills, so that an early arrival would be the only way to take advantage of the abundance. Remarkably, the chimps would get up earlier for trees far from their nests than for those nearby, arriving at about the same time at both. This suggests calculation of travel time based on expected distances. All this makes Janmaat believe that the Thai chimpanzees actively recall previous experiences in order to plan for a plentiful breakfast. The Estonian-Canadian psychologist Endel Tulving defined episodic memory as the recall of what happened at which place